everyone, and welcome once again to Nikonian's Image Doctors. This is episode number 43 for June 21st, 2007. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And Rick, you're back from vacation, aren't you?
I am. Actually, it's been a while since we've recorded. It's probably not obvious, but we pre-record these things, and sometimes they're just a few days before the release date, and sometimes they're several weeks. So it's actually been a while. But yeah, I was away on a trip to Greece.
Don't tell anybody about our secret time warp technology that we have.
Oh, it is a secret, too.
I hear it's a new thing on Windows Vista. So how was your trip?
It was great.
Good. Well, I assume you took a lot of photographs, right?
I took a fair number. And as usual, I stewed over what I was going to take and then completely changed my mind within the last few days. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, that happens.
I had good intentions of simplicity. Let me put it that way. That's as far as they got.
Oh, the best of intentions, aren't they? Yeah. So we'll talk about your trip and, and your experience there in Greece and the Mediterranean. And then we want to spend some time today catching up on our listener mailbag. We've been kind of delinquent answering some questions.
So right. We're going to do a bunch of them.
We've got a whole lot of mail to answer. And then, of course, our photo prescription, as always. So let's start off with talking about Greece. I've never been there, but I hear it's really cool.
Yeah, it was great. It was the first time there. I went with my family. So this was primarily a family trip, although, as usual, you know, I squeeze in as much photography as I can get. But it wasn't the primary thrust. And I was mentioning earlier, I had these really great intentions of making things simple and lightweight and compact and not getting burdened down with stuff. And
40 pounds of gear later,
I failed. I guess I started panicking or something like that. What I was going to take was my D200, which is, you know, a really nice lightweight digital body. And I was going to take an 18 to 200 VR.
And that would have been it?
It would have been probably pretty good, but I didn't take that. So instead,
so what did we do?
I had a film fest is the way I would describe it. Yeah.
You so really went on a time warp.
Yeah, I did, sort of. I ended up taking my F6 body, and we've talked about that a bit in the past. It's just a great camera to use. I think it's still one of my favorites in terms of, you know, handling and
it came out
features.
About 5 years too late.
Yeah.
In terms of from
it's
a sales
probably
perspective.
True. That's probably true because great camera and a lot of people haven't had a chance to use it really. But I took the F6. I took my 17 to 35 2.8, another wonderful lens that I don't use a whole lot with digital. I took my 85 1.4, you know, kind of ditto there, frankly. It's I love the focal length on film cameras, but it's just a little bit long for my taste on digital. And then I tucked in a 180 2.8, which is another lens that I just don't use a lot with digital. But again, you know, great lens. So in effect, I was digging out some of the older stuff that I love a lot, but haven't been using lately. And then I
and you took it on an international travel.
I did, yeah. And I took a whole bunch of Provia 100 film. It's a nice general purpose film that I like for travel. It's got, you know, a nice amount of saturation and it's a little bit on the warm side, but not nearly as strong as Velvia, and it's, you know, not nearly as contrasty as Velvia either. So it works a lot better for scanning, I think. You get, you know, more shadow detail and stuff like that.
And this is a slide film.
It's a slide film.
Provia.
Right. Right. I stuck in a few rolls of the newer 400X Provia. Never used it though. The light was good enough there in Greece on a pretty consistent basis that I ended up using the 100 all the time. And threw a lightweight tripod in my suitcase, and of course my suitcase got delayed by a couple days when we arrived, so I was a little bit panicked that my tripod was gone, but it showed up. So things happen when you have a lot of airplane flights to get somewhere, and we did on this trip. It was three to get to Greece.
Oof.
So my tripod spent some time in Toronto, unfortunately.
Hey, maybe, you know, did you ask it if it had any pictures?
I don't think it did. I think it was pretty quiet there. But, of course, I couldn't leave it at that. You know, I thought, hey, I'm going film, taking a film route, so why not bring my panoramic camera too? So I brought my X-Pan, you know, which is a It's a discontinued camera now. It's made by Hasselblad, and we talked a little bit about it when we were discussing panoramic images a while back. But it's a rangefinder that takes images that are on 35 millimeter film, but it's the same height as a normal 35 millimeter film image, but it's considerably wider. It's rather than being 24 by 36, it's 24 by 65, and a couple lenses with that, a 45 and a 90. So I had a lot of junk. It's not as bad as it sounds. I threw it all in a pretty small backpack for the plane trips, a mini trekker backpack. Mm-hmm. But when I was actually out shooting, what I would do is take one or the other, and I wouldn't necessarily take all the lenses if I was shooting with the F6. And coincidentally, I used a Domke F6 bag, when I was actually out shooting, which is just a small, lightweight canvas thing that's pretty simple. And so I was just using subsets of the equipment, depending on kind of shooting I wanted to do and the locale, and it actually worked out great. The only thing that drove me a little bit crazy is, with the airline security the way it is, and we were actually on a whole bunch of flights, the way it turned out, not just getting over to Greece, but once we were there, we hopped around the islands a bit and took a lot of plane flights, and boy, you have to put your stuff through scanners a lot. And at the beginning, I tried going the route of asking them to check the film, do a hand check. And they were really nice about it and did it, but good Lord, they opened up every single container and box, and it just took a long time. And in the end, I decided, I'm probably going to use the ISO 100 stuff the most. I'll just risk it. And the images were fine. I got them back, no problem. I don't know what would have happened with the 400 stuff after probably roughly a dozen scans, through machines. But, I'll probably do an experiment now with the film that I've got at home.
I think when you're traveling with 35 millimeter film, the best way to, if you don't want them to scan it, you need to take all the film out of the box, out of the canisters, and just have the film roll itself with the leader out, which is great. Well, I guess you can't have the leader out if you've already shot the roll, but put it into a clear Ziploc bag and give them that. Then there's no question that it's really film.
Right.
But sometimes they'll do the thing where they'll swab every individual canister. I've had that experience, and it can really be a pain. And that is one thing about my switch to digital that I don't miss at all.
No,
it's traveling with film.
It's a lot easier with digital, but it worked out okay. In reality, it wasn't a problem with the images I took. Like I said, I don't know what would have happened with the 400 speed, but the 100 speed film was all fine. And my son took his D70. And unfortunately had some problems with it at the start of the trip. And the reason I mention it is it gets into the idea of a backup body, which I often take. I've never used one, as a backup so far, but in this case, we ended up having to do that. And on our very first day, we were shooting at the Acropolis, and all of a sudden, this D70 just started fritzing out. And it was acting a little flaky, like the on and off switch was a little bit weird, and then it wouldn't even come on. And so he and I ended up, switching off between the X-Pan and the F6, which worked out fine. And actually, he had a lot of fun, especially with the X-Pan. It's just such a different beast. Mm-hmm. It does inspire some creativity with the format. So he really enjoyed it and got some great shots with it, too, at the start. And then, miraculously, the D70 came back to life, a few days later. Huh. And so he was able to shoot with it for the majority of the
trip. Any idea of what it was?
No. We're just going to watch it. For a while there, we thought, okay, bye-bye D70. And he's gotten a tremendous amount of use out of it. But he really wasn't ready to let go of it either. There's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. From his standpoint, it produces great images. So we'll just see. It was very hot and humid, those first couple days. So I guess it could be something like that. But
When your son goes back to school, you can send it off to service and have it looked at.
Yeah.
When he's not missing it as much.
We'll just see. Yeah.
Hopefully it just... I've heard stories where you just need to do a hard reset and you'll get a strange thing and a reset of it and it's all better.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's some known D70 issues that Nikon will fix for free of charge, even if it's not under warranty anymore. So
yeah,
it's just nice to know.
Yeah, we'll just see. So far, it's not recurred, so.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, but it was a great trip. Greece is very nice. It's beautiful.
I've only seen two of your images, and they were fantastic.
Yeah, those were
classic white Mediterranean buildings on the island with the blue.
Right, those were both taken with the X-Pan, both panoramic, and yeah, it was fun. You know, shooting with film is a different experience. We've talked about that before. Never mind the issues with security scanners and stuff like that. I did have fun shooting with it. It's, you know, a little bit different thought process. It's not hard. You know, even with slide film that has a more narrow latitude, it's not difficult. You know, sometimes you get awfully used to using a histogram and things like that. And then when you first switch back, you feel a little bit odd, like, oh my gosh, my safety net isn't there, but it's not hard. And it was actually kind of fun.
You can still trust your light meter most of the time.
It actually worked pretty darn well.
Well, that's great, and it's good to have you back, of course, so we can continue to do these podcasts. I just got to figure out a vacation for myself, so because I'm jealous now.
And now I got to get busy with scanning. You know, I'm definitely a little bit behind schedule on that.
The workflow slows down a little bit.
It does slow down a little bit. It's not hard, but
I think it's a great thing because it really does force you when you have the time constraint of sitting around and waiting for a slide to be scanned. Because when you scan them at high resolution, that's not especially if you turn on all the features on a scanner like the digital ice and all those extra processing steps. Mm-hmm. Even on a fairly fast computer, a scan's going to take, you know, a couple of minutes possibly. Mm-hmm. That really makes you think twice about which images you really want to spend the time to put in your scanner and go through. It makes you have a little more critical eye, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you, actually, it's just a matter of getting motivated to do it. When I actually sit down and do scans from a trip, it's not that painful. It's usually what I'll do is I'll go through and, you know, pick out an initial image, get the scanner going on that one. And while it's cooking on it, then I'll start looking for the next image and going through. And usually right around the time that the scanner finishes, I've got the next image ready to go. And you know, it's not as bad as it seems, actually.
But you do need to set aside some time.
Yeah.
You know, that's a serious evening of scanning.
Yeah.
Maybe more than one.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
Okay, so let's dig into the listener mailbag. And because we've got several items that we want to discuss, because we've been getting a fair bit of email over the last few weeks from our listeners. And of course, as you probably know by now, we remind you every week, you can send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and Rick and I will try to answer your email, usually the same day we get it.
Right.
But we try to answer all our emails, and if it's really juicy, we'll try to use it in a podcast episode. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you have other questions, you can always suggest show topics and ask questions in the Nikonians podcast feedback forum, which is in the Nikonians discussions area. So let's start by opening up our mailbag, and we'll start with a question that we got from Joseph White. And Joseph wanted to know, he was thinking about upgrading from a D70S to a D200, and I can understand why. Mm-hmm. And he says he has a few of the EN-EL3A batteries, which came with his D70S, and he noticed that the D200 takes the EN-EL3A. E battery. So what Joseph wants to know is whether he can use his older ENEL-3As with the D200, or can he only use the ENEL-3E batteries? Well, Rick, do you want to answer that one?
Sure. If you get a nice new D200, you unfortunately do need to get some new batteries. Now, one will come with it, but if you want a spare or a couple spares, you'll need to get the ENL3E. I think I said that right.
Yeah.
It's the E version, whatever the
whatever it has the E on
letters
the
and stuff are.
Correct.
And the reason is that it's the newer battery has a little chip in it that works with the D200, and it's what also enables the very nice, precise battery indicator that shows you percentages to work. Now, you can use that newer battery in an older camera. That E version will work in a D70S, but the other way around doesn't work. The older batteries don't work in the new one.
And I think they're physically incompatible. I believe that there's some little pin or notch or somewhere in one and the other that you can't actually put an EN-EL3 or 3A into the D200.
I believe
you're
right.
It just won't let it work, whereas that limitation does not happen in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hopefully that answers your question.
By the way, we, in researching this too, you know, just to confirm our memories on this, we did find a really neat little battery compatibility chart on the Nikon USA website. So we'll put a link into it in our podcast notes.
Yeah, and it was under the technical support in the FAQ section. Mm-hmm. I just did a keyword search for battery, and one of the articles was compatibility chart. Mm-hmm. So that worked out really good. Moving on to our next question and next topic in the mailbag, we got an email from David Neefsey from the UK, and he wanted to know if we could talk about shooting products in a light tent. Products, usually it's like something small, like jewelry or small objects that you would use for probably a store website. You know, here's a product. You know, and you just want to have a nice clean background. And a lot of times what you'll see is, you know, these shots are look like the object is floating in space and it's all white behind it. Now you can do some tricks in Photoshop or your post-processing to try to get that what's called the high key effect. But the easiest way to be able to remove those backgrounds is to have a nice white background in the first place. And there's a product called something called a light tent, which is just a big diffuser, actually. A lot of times they pop up, they're sort of self-supporting. And then they have, it will be a diffuser on, think of it as a cube. Cube has, what, six sides. And one of those sides will be open, so you can put your camera lens into the tent and shoot into it. And the other sides are just this diffuser material. And the idea when you use one of these is to set up usually studio strobes or possibly even just regular speed lights, remote speed lights around this tent so that the object in there is on a white background and the light is coming in from all sides is real diffuse light, and it works really well.
And it's bouncing around a lot too.
Right. So you get diffuse light, you don't get harsh shadows, and you get really nice clean images. And another trick that you can do depending on the size of your light tent, is you can put it on, you can use a light box like you might use for a slide viewer, a plain light box as the base. So you put the light box on a table, you put the tent on top of the light box, and then you have white light coming in from below as well. So you can really get that floating effect, that high key lighting effect.
Now, one thing that you want to watch if you use the slide box that you were talking about is mixing it with strobes. And I wouldn't do that because chances are it's a different temperature light source. You know, very often those slide boxes have something like an incandescent bulb in it, at least mine does, whereas a strobe will be somewhere close to daylight.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll get a weird mix if you use the two. So use one or the other, or use some light sources that are the same, you know, confirm that.
Yeah, I have a light box that actually has daylight adjusted fluorescent tubes.
And that'll work.
And those aren't hard to find. Mm-hmm. You know, most of us aren't doing critical slide evaluation anymore. You don't have to spend the big bucks on the expensive light tubes. Mm-hmm. I think I just went to the local, you know, hardware store, home improvement store, and found some light tubes that were daylight.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were, you know, intended to use, you know, natural white color temperature balance. And those work pretty well.
Yeah. Just confirm
with
what
a flash.
You've got. Yeah.
So you can try that. Now there's a lot more information out there and some places to look. And one really good resource for learning how to set up lighting is on the PhotoFlex website, photoflex.com. That's PhotoFlex. And they sell some kits of what they call the light igloos. It's the same idea. It's for product shots.
eBay and shots would be a
yeah. If you're
use.
Selling something on eBay,
mm-hmm.
Exactly, because you don't want that harsh lighting, and you want to have no shadows.
Right.
you can go to the photoflex.com website, check out, they have some really inexpensive kits, where you can get, light igloos of various sizes, and some have even come with some studio lighting, some strobes that you can use. You don't have to go that hard, but if you, are doing this for a living or you're shooting products, that's the way to go about it. And then they have some instructional, web pages on their website where they show you how to position the lights and get these different effects, but that's how it's done.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other, you know, quick thing, if you're using a digital camera, this is a great situation to shoot raw and use that exposed to the right sort of approach, you know, where you make a few test shots and use some exposure comp to nudge your histogram to the right. And you'll want to do that because you've got that white background and there's a good chance that it might fool the meter and turn out kind of gray. And then when you correct that, it'll end up a little bit noisy. So
that's, you know, a good point.
Just check the histogram, do some test shots, and then your chances are you'll be able to use the same settings for the rest of your mm-hmm. shoot.
Okay. So now moving on, we have yet another email. This one comes from Brian Shoup, and he's from Boston, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And Brian, in addition to your nice kudos in your email, we thank you for those.
Yeah, we won't read those off, but they were very nice.
Brian wanted to know, he's trying to decide between a D80 and a D200. And he was looking across the features, and one of the features between the D80 and the D200 is the light meter, mm-hmm. namely the pixel count in the segments in the matrix metering, where the D80 has a 420 pixel meter, the D200 has a 1,005 pixel meter. And he wanted to know how much of a difference this really makes. You know, should that be a critical decision point when looking at purchasing a camera? And so what we thought we'd do is we'd talk about that difference, but really remind everyone about the differences when choosing between a D80 and a D200, because the cameras are pretty close. It's a pretty big price difference. There's a fairly large price difference between the D80 and the D200. So all other things being equal, what really sets those two cameras apart in terms of things you should be concerned about?
Mm-hmm. So some good questions. You know, first let's talk about the issue of number of pixels or segments or whatever on a matrix meter. You know, earlier ones didn't have a whole lot, and then they got up to the range of like 8 or 10 or whatever, depending on the brand and the model. And frankly, that's probably good enough for most purposes. Now, when you see the really high number of different segments, I think what you're talking about, and this is kind of a guess on my part, is just a little bit different technology that's being used for the actual meter. And I would be willing to bet that a lot of those segments and stuff or pixels are grouped together, you know, in the meter's algorithms. In other words, it's not actively using every single little pixel on its own separately in order to judge exposure. So it's probably taking groups of those and then grouping them together so that they end up looking a lot like, you know, some of the older meters and stuff. The number of segments, you know, sometimes gets used when you're adjusting the size of a center-weighted pattern, and it's an advantage there. But I really would not use, you know, the number of pixels or whatever in a meter is a gauge of quality. The algorithms behind it, how you use the meter yourself, is going to be a much bigger factor than the number of pixels. My personal advice is ignore it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't use that as a basis for decision.
Treat that as the critical deciding
factor.
I mean, is the 1,005 pixel meter better? Probably. Is it better enough that you're going to see it on a daily basis with the kind of photography you're using it for? Probably not.
You know, a lot of these things end up being incredibly small factors in the success of your photos. They might improve the number of keepers from, let's say, 94 to 94.5%. If you really want to get closer to 100, you improve your technique and mm-hmm. how you're using the meter.
And it's hard because we get a lot of these features are brought up in the marketing literature, and they talk about having this 1,005 pixels, segment meter.
Yeah.
And so you think, wow, that must be pretty important.
Yeah. And just, you know, as a little side excursion, I think it's very easy when you're reading camera reviews or looking at stuff on the internet or listening to us to sometimes misinterpret things that you've heard or seen. And a lot of people want reviews to be much stronger than they really probably should be. We talked about this one time in the past, you know, and a long time ago we did a review of the super wide zooms. And people were a little bit frustrated with this because we didn't say, oh, absolutely, this is the one to get. It's clearly better than the others. And the honest truth was, they were all pretty decent. But people don't like hearing that sometimes. They want to hear that there was this profound difference. And if you use this camera or your lens, you'll just get outrageously better shots. And that's really not the case. You know, the photographic knowledge, the person behind the lens or the camera is what really counts. And it's not always a popular thing, but that's really the case. The difference between things is often fairly small in a lot of situations.
Yeah, so. And it's better to have an understanding and a knowledge of the limitations of the equipment that you mm-hmm. have so that you know how to use it correctly right. rather than just to have always the most expensive. Because a lot of times the relationship between quality and price is not linear.
No, and it's not even
when you double the price. When you double the price, you don't necessarily double the quality.
Right.
So there's a diminishing returns at some point.
And good stuff is fun to use. But yeah, don't expect a quantum leap in your photos. That just comes through time.
Now let's talk about some of the more profound differences between the D80 and the D200, just mm-hmm. off the top of our head. I know we brought it up a little bit once before. Why would you want to choose one or the other? Well, first of all, price, mm-hmm. because I think in the United States, a D200 is still around a $1,600 right. plus camera body. Mm-hmm. You might find them on sale. I've rarely seen them for less than that. Whereas a D80 is in the $1,000 range. So you're talking about, you know, 50%, 60% higher price mm-hmm. for the D200. Not necessarily 60% better camera. What the major differences are, one is going to be the construction. The mm-hmm. D200 has more metal in it.
It's yeah.
a little more
better
solid,
seals.
Better seals. So, you know, that's certainly a part of the reason of the higher price.
Now, talking a little bit about that, there's a psychological thing with it, probably more than a practical thing.
You were talking about the price?
The construction quality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Not like these other, you know, because like your son's D70 is taking a beating and on ticking, so.
At least for a while.
Yeah.
But well, I'm not sure it's necessarily, the problem that he ran into is necessarily a construction thing. You know, maybe it's seals, maybe it was humidity, I don't know. It's been in far worse situations in rainforests and stuff like that. And
the polycarbonate that they use to construct these quote plastic bodies is darn strong.
Yeah. I actually think that in my case, I like using cameras that are a little bit heavier and a little bit better built. And I'll freely admit that. That is important to me. When I've owned cameras in the past that were more lighter weight in construction, like, you know, a long time ago I had a D100. I just honestly didn't enjoy using the camera as much because of the way it felt. That may be stupid, that may be impractical.
But you're entitled to that.
Yeah, and I know it. So I would rather use a D200 than a D80 just for that reason alone. And yeah, you need to figure out what's important to you.
Right. And now, technology speaking, the D80 and the D200 both have the same autofocus module. Mm-hmm. Where you run into a little bit of difference is that the D80 has a slower frame rate.
Right.
I believe it tops out at 3 frames per second, whereas with the D200, you can shoot at 5 frames per second. So if action photography, if you're going to take pictures at something that's a fast-moving sport, like baseball, mm-hmm. where you're trying to get the ball in the frame. And that's where having a higher frame rate will help you. You're more likely, it's not that you can't get the photograph with the D80, it's just that you're more likely in a burst shooting 5 frames a second to have one of those images in the sequence be what you want.
Right.
It's hard to do even with 8 frames a second, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, and there's only so much you can do with, you know, stuff with using your eye and your own reflexes and stuff. with some action oriented things, you can catch the peak movement or timing just with one shot. But
yeah,
some sports are awfully difficult.
And once upon a time, that's how all the sports photographers shot. They didn't have the fancy motor winders. And even if they did, they weren't getting outrageous frame advance rates. Mm-hmm. The other major difference between the D200 and the D80 is the form factor of the memory.
Right.
And if you're coming from the bottom, working your way up, the D80 uses secure digital cards, which are smaller form factor and share the same compatibility with a lot of the point and shoot cameras out there. So if you already have a library, if you already have a couple of these SD cards, that might be useful to you.
Now, one thing I'll point out, though, because when my son's camera was on the Fritz, you know, we started thinking a little bit about, you know,
the backup body situation.
What might he have to replace it with? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's got a bunch of the compact flash cards, mm-hmm. the same kind that would be used for the D200. And in the past, that really kind of tipped the scales because... Yeah, the D80 was cheaper, but then you had the cost of the flash cards. And that's still a factor, but boy, prices have come down.
Right.
They've come down so much that, you know, in his case, he's got some older 1 gig and 2 gig cards, some 512 meg cards. And those are just ridiculously cheap now. Even something like a 4 gig card is pretty darn cheap.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's less of a factor than it was in the past.
Now, one factor that you have to consider, though, is that I'll have to go back and double check the specs. But mm-hmm. there was with the secure digital SD format.
Mm-hmm.
Until recently, the capacity of those cards maxed out at 2 gigabytes.
You can get 4 gig now,
but they're a different factor. They're something called SDHC or high capacity,
okay.
And they're only compatible with devices that are there. The SDHC, high capacity, and the SD format are not backwards compatible.
Mm.
If your camera can read SDHC, it can also read SD. But if your camera cannot read SDHC, you're limited to using the old kind of cards.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just something to think about. I would think that the D80 would be able to handle those because it's a fairly newer body, but I'll have to double check. Like, I know the D40 will read the SDHC cards, so you could use either your old cards or your new cards.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have, but if you want to get the higher capacity cards, you have to just keep in mind that they're out of that format. Well, as compact flash, you can get up to 16 gigabyte cards, and there's no limitation, I don't think, mm-hmm. on the, at least with the any camera in the last few years, there's no issues with using those higher capacity cards.
Yeah.
But that's pretty minor. I mean, with something like that, those are really the big difference. When I look at a D80, I see more of the scene modes being built in,
mm-hmm.
whereas the D200 does not have the program scene modes. That's tells you about the kind of photographer it's tailored to. I mean, Rick and I never use the program scene modes, even if they were available for us. They can be a useful starting point sometimes to just see what the camera's doing, but we don't use them. But if you're a casual shooter and you like to be able to hand the camera to someone and just put it in program mode and just use it, you're going to get that in the D80 and you won't have that in the D200. So it's something to think about.
Yeah.
But otherwise.
I have a hunch that the biggest discriminator is going to be the way it feels, the size, et cetera. And that can go both ways.
So
some people will prefer the smaller, lighter form factor of the D80, and others like me will, you know, instantly go for the D200. It just depends.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And so that goes back to our old advice, which is before you buy a camera, go to the store, see how they feel, check it out, look at the menus, look at the interface, see how it feels in your hand, and then decide then, you know, mm-hmm. that's the one you want.
Mm-hmm.
But the differences between those two bodies really are pretty minor.
Yeah. By the way, one thing in Brian's letter, he said he noted that we didn't seem to be Canon fans, and just to clarify that, we'll kid about that. but Canon makes good stuff. I'm sure if we were using it, we'd be very happy with it. We're both very happy with our Nikon equipment, though, and have not seen any big reasons to switch. In fact, probably more of the other. But I'm sure we'd be very happy with Canon stuff too.
I've yet to, at least in my experience, be able to look at a picture on a, you know, online, or anywhere for, or in National Geographic and say, that probably came from a Canon.
Yeah.
You know, and I've not run into a situation where I haven't been able to get a shot because
no,
I'm not shooting a,
and I think it's,
and the other way around would work too.
Yeah. And the stuff that we're printing out in very large sizes is just so darn good looking. It's just amazing to me sometimes. And I'm not talking about our skills as photographers. I'm just talking about the detail and the clarity. It's kind of amazing to me when I think back on images that I was printing out, you know, 10 years ago. I never thought I would be getting stuff of this quality from a camera so small, you know, and using my old Nikon lenses. So I'm pretty happy.
Not okay. That there isn't room for improvement, Nikon. Hey, we want you to keep pushing forward.
We're as nuts as everyone else. Always want more.
So, yeah. But that's a great point, Rick.
Yeah.
So thanks for that email, Brian. We really appreciate that. And now that we'll come up to our last dig into the very bottom of the mailbag and our last topic. We got an email from Brad Beauchemin. And I'm sure I'm saying your last name wrong, Brad, so you can punish us next time in another email. Brad's from Oregon in the United States. And amongst other things, Brad wants to know about whether it's a good idea to take your prints to a lab and have them done that way, or just invest in a fancy color printer and do your own printing at home. And that's a great question. And so I can say that both Rick and I chose to do our printing at home.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say we wouldn't have gone to a lab. I've taken stuff to labs, not digital, but when I had slides, I certainly did. But the reason why we feel like, you know, there's a couple of reasons why printing from home now is such an attractive, for and we're talking about for larger prints.
Right.
I mean, I think there's still nothing easier than taking a memory card full of images down to your local drugstore to the kiosk or whatever and having 4x6s made.
Yeah, I think if you're talking, you know, bunch of 4x6 prints, for example,
online.
Yeah, if I'd taken my D200 on this trip to Greece and I wanted to produce a whole bunch of 4x6s, I would probably take them down to lab and not use my printer at home just because of the time and the expense and everything. But for bigger prints, I like having the control over the image, being able to print it, immediately see what's going on there, make some corrections, reprint. And I do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't want to be waiting, you know, days or whatever to get something back. It's just a whole lot easier and frankly more satisfying too to be able to print at home.
And honestly, the quality of the printers now, I mean, I look at what's coming out of our printers now and I think back to, you know, my first color printer, which I think was an Epson Stylus Color 2.
Mm-hmm.
By no means was it a photo printer. But it was just the fact that it could print color. And I think back to what I was printing then and I remember with each iteration going, wow, you can almost not even see the dots, you know, and now there's nothing to distinguish what comes out of a printer if you use good paper,
mm-hmm.
what comes out of a modern printer, inkjet, from a photograph. And in some cases, you can get better quality than with the photographic processes. Now, the big key to this whole thing is, could you find a lab to give you the results that you wanted? Without question. You go to a good lab and they'll work with you because it's an iterative process. You don't know, you know, there's certain, you know, black box component. If you just send your photos out, are they going to sharpen them again? Do you need to have them saved in a particular color space for color?
What kind of paper are they using?
What kind of paper? What kind of printer are they using? And I don't know a whole lot about how to set up prints for the Fuji Frontier printers. I really don't know what the settings are. But if you get a good lab, they'll work with you and they'll tell you how to set it up. And if the print isn't to your liking, they will redo it for you. Depending on where that lab is, you know, that could be really no big deal, or it could be a real problem. If you're sending your prints online somewhere, you know, out of state or, you know, far away, you might not be able to work with them as well. And there's a long turnaround time between seeing the results and getting back something that you like. Whereas if you've got a camera shop here in town where you can, you know, go in there and work with the people, then you're going to get very good results probably because they're going to aim to, you know, you're their customer. They're going to want to help you out.
I think one of the things it comes down to is if you're going to make larger prints frequently, then it probably makes sense to invest in your own printer and just have that control. If it's something that you're going to do very seldom, mm-hmm. then go for the lab. And it's kind of the same decision that I've made for really large prints. You know, if I want, I've got a printer that will only go to 13 by 19, or I guess it'll do 13 by a longer length. But that's good enough for most of the time. And fortunately, I know someone that's got a big printer.
Oh, you do, huh?
I do. But, you know, I could also go out to a commercial lab and have the larger prints made. And, you know, it's seldom enough that that works okay. And I think the same general thought process can apply with smaller prints.
That's true. And what I, you know, and then the second part of your question, you wanted to know about this. I mentioned I had stitched together a 5-shot image of one of the mountain formations here in Colorado Springs, and I printed it approximately 5 feet wide. It was 55 inches long by about 23 inches tall.
It's huge.
It is. It's very large. And believe me, the expense was getting it framed, not printing it.
Right.
But my workflow that I used to produce that image wasn't really any different than what I would do for a 4x6 print or a 5x7 print. Once I had the image stitched together in the PT GUI software that I used, I created a TIFF and brought that TIFF into Photoshop, and then I was able to use my standard soft proofing, where I enabled the soft proofing and set it up to be the printer paper profile for my Epson 7800. Is that what it is? Yeah. So I go look at it. Epson 7800 on premium luster photo paper. And then that allowed me to make some slight tweaks to the contrast and saturation so that it would look better on the print. A lot of times you lose a little contrast and a little saturation when you move from what you see on the screen to on the printed paper. And so soft proofing with a calibrated monitor is the way to do this. And then I used the Nick Sharpener Pro 2.0 to do the output sharpening. The image had already been sharpened for capture sharpening from the D2X in Capture NX. I took each individual frame that I had for the panorama and mm-hmm. processed them in NX exactly the same way. So I didn't do any local contrast adjustments. Really, I waited until I had stitched the image together. So I took the raw files. I outputted them all to TIFFs using the same output setting.
Probably 8-bit TIFFs them a little bit smaller.
I don't remember what I did at that time, but 8-bit was fine. If you're going from RAW to TIFF, usually you can get away with 8-bit because you've done most of your massive adjustments in the RAW phase while it's still in the 16-bit mode. And then I did the sharpening, and then I printed a test shot small just to make sure that it would look right, the colors looked right. And then I used the roll paper option and pushed the print button and cross my fingers, because you never know what's gonna, you know, you figure the one time you do something really massive, that's when the print head will clog or something like that.
Right.
But I didn't have any issues with it. You know, I made sure the printer was turned on and clean, you know, the print heads were clean before I tried to print something really large like that. I usually run a test print through anyway, just to make sure that the ink is flowing. And I haven't had any problems with the print heads clogging on this printer, mm-hmm. incidentally. But, and that's how it worked. It really wasn't any different than if I was printing something at 5x7. It was just bigger paper, and I just made sure that it had the printer set up so that it would slice off the roll when it was all said and done.
Yeah.
And then I rolled it up and took it to my framer and gave them, you know, half my salary. And,
I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, though. It truly is amazing sometimes what you can produce using the stuff that's made today, both in terms of printers and camera bodies and lenses. It's just remarkable. And when you look at that print on the wall, and it is huge, it doesn't matter if you're standing 10 feet away or a foot away. It's sharp. It's detailed. It looks great. And I'm still amazed you know, the stuff that you can
it's produce. It's only a matter today. Of time before he brings one over and wants me to print one that big for
yeah,
him.
Yeah, and when I think about stuff from 10 years ago where I was shooting 35 millimeter film, and like I said, I like film, but when I was having to drop it off to a commercial processor to have even an 8x10 made, and it came back out of focus, poorly exposed, color balance was wrong. It was just frustrating. And, you know, when an 8x10 isn't even sharp, you don't want to do it a lot, or you do it yourself. And that's what I ended up doing a lot of times was my own processing, but that's a lot of work too. And now it's just easy.
And quite frankly, my opinion after trying all this stuff out is that I don't know if I could have gotten a shot that sharp with film.
Right.
Because of just with the grain.
Yeah.
Just because of the grain. I don't know if I could have done that.
Yeah.
Just, it's amazing how sharp images I can get. You kind of lose touch with where you used to be. And what was sharp enough back then would be considered soft now.
Right.
It's amazing.
Well, that image, you know, it's so large, it looks like it had to have been taken with a view camera. That's what it looks
It was
like.
Fun. I had a good time. Now, one before, Brad, before we leave your question, there is one special little tip I want to, it's an easy place to make mistakes. We've talked about color management in the past. The trick where people run into trouble is after you've calibrated your monitor with whatever hardware you have, a lot of times people will go into the color management palette of their editing software, whether it's Photoshop or Capture or whatever it might be. Do not make the mistake of setting the color management settings to have the color space of your application be your monitor color space. You want to always have the application set to be either sRGB or Adobe RGB. The monitor color
Or one of the wider gamut ones if you're using that.
If you go that
those
route.
Are the two most popular.
But do not set your application to use the calibration, the profile from your monitor. That will screw everything up if you do that. And then the other tip is that if you're going to use that color managed workflow, make sure you disable the printer color management from your printer driver when you go to print. Let the application handle the color management. Turn off the printer color management. Otherwise, you'll get skewed stuff and you won't have any idea of how to fix it. It'll be very strange looking because the printer color management is compensating on top of what the application's already mm-hmm. done. So those two things are real important to keep in mind. But we appreciate certainly all of the emails that we've been getting, and we want to continue to use your emails as show topics. It helps us a lot too. Mm-hmm. And not to mention, we just like hearing from our listeners.
Yep.
So don't forget, send us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we will be sure to answer your question or use your topic in a future show.
All right. Now, one last thing, and then we better shut up because we're running long on time.
That's true. And we want to talk about a photo prescription for this time. And this is something that our photo prescription for this week is something we stole from a great photographer, Dave Black, who we interviewed, great sports photographer. And I was thinking about Dave Black because I just saw one of his photographs in the current month's issue of National Geographic. Mm-hmm. He had gone to Washington, D.C. last year, and he had mentioned that he was leaving for that trip right after I saw him at the sports workshop.
Right.
And lo and behold, his shots from that trip now seem to be making their way into magazines. But Dave Black's got a great, interesting trick for what he calls moody blue lighting. It's really interesting. And it takes advantage of flash and digital with a custom white balance setting. And the way that it works is what he's trying to achieve is sort of a dark, very blue background. And you would use this lighting for like a portrait, for interesting portrait lighting, where the subject of the person that you're taking the picture of is very warm, very natural looking, but everything around them is dark and moody blue.
Right. And so you end up with this spotlit look that really makes the subject just pop out of the photo.
It's neat.
Yeah, it really is quite cool. If you go to his website, which is what?
It's DaveBlackPhotography.com.
Yeah, you can see some examples there.
I'll put a link up to there on,
yeah,
on our
good
site.
Idea. But let's talk about how it works, because you've used this technique with
portraits. And it's not something that I would have even been able to do with film, because you couldn't set the white balance that, you know, quite that way.
You would have had to use tungsten film, maybe.
But what the idea is that to get this lighting technique to work, you need two things. You need to have a digital camera, which I assume a lot of our listeners do. And then you need to have something like an SB800 or SB600. And the SB800 in particular comes with a set of colored gels. One's green and one's orange. And in this case, you're going to use the orange gel. You take your camera and you set the... And what you'll want to do is set the white balance to something in the 3,500 to 3,700 direct Kelvin setting. So that's going to make the image be blue to begin with. It's going to look very strange if you were to just set that up and do that. And then what I usually do is I use my light meter reading from the background. So I meter off the background and I set the camera to manual and I dial in the exposure so that it's underexposed by about one stop. So one stop underexposed, whatever that might be.
You could even go even darker if you wanted to.
You could go darker. Yeah. And it's interesting, you can get away with this with the SB800 in particular if you set, depending on the distance to your subject, but we assume you're doing a portrait. A lot of times, if you are close enough to your subject, you can use the FP sync mode in your camera so that you can achieve the... underexposed background by using a fast shutter speed, something faster than 250th of a second. Mm-hmm. But what that does, the consequence of that is that it reduces the output of your flash. You got to make sure that your SB800 is pointed directly at your subject. And then you're going to set the SB800 to have an exposure of somewhere in the +2 to +3. You'll have to play around with that with your histogram a little bit. So you dial in plus compensation on the flash, and you have effectively an underexposed background. What that's going to do is it's going to compensate for your subject and make that subject really pop out, give you that spotlit appearance. And then the gel on the flash counteracts the white balance setting for the subject of your image. So wherever the flash hits, you'll get a nice natural to warm looking subject. But in the background, which we assume is outdoors somewhere, it'll stay blue because the flash isn't lighting that up. And that's a really neat and powerful technique. And Dave has shown how to do this on his website. If you go to daveblackphotography.com and you click on his workshops at the ranch, he talks about his moody blue lighting settings. But if you use it, it can work in some situations, and it just gives your image something different.
Very different.
And he's used it in football stadiums, mm-hmm. with the players running by. So experiment with that. Combination of the gel and the manual white balance setting really can do some fun stuff for your pictures.
Yep. And I think that wraps up this show.
I think so. We've yammered on long enough.
Yep.
So we thank you all for listening once again. And until next time, happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.